Welcome to the Sunday special on the Virginia Voice. For today's program, we have two interviews and readings. First, we have Don Dale interviewing Harry Kolatz, senior writer for Richmond Magazine and one of the board members for the Podium Foundation. The second interview is with Tarfia Faizullah. Rick Ryder is the Virginia Voice interviewer, and Tarfia will be reading some of her own poetry as well as some of the poetry from Podium. Tarfia is one of the editorial mentors for the Podium Foundation and worked with editors of Volume 2 of the Podium, which will be launched on June 13th at Dogwood Dell.
My name is Don Dale, and my guest today is Harry Kolatz, who is a board member of the Podium Foundation and a senior writer for Richmond Magazine. You may recognize him by his hat.
Which you cannot see.
Not on the radio.
But if you could see, I would be wearing a hat.
And you are, in fact, wearing a hat.
I am, in fact,
wearing... There is a word for this type of hat, which, and I don't mean to dwell on the hat, Harry, but it is such a part of who you are.
Yeah. Well, it's a straw. It's a straw Panama is what it is. A straw fedora, I guess you could call it.
And it has become a logo for your column in Richmond Magazine.
It has. It has indeed. I have various hats, and I wear them quite often, depending on the weather and my mood. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, if I'm having a bad hair day, well, or no hair day, as the case may be, I have a hat with which to display my relationship with the world.
Somebody told me once that writing is fairly easy. All you do is sit down at a keyboard and blood oozes from your forehead.
Yeah, Jules Renard, I think, said all you have to do is sit down and open a vein. And it's very true.
Do you find it hard to do?
Well, deadlines help, you know. Knowledge to be executed in the morning does concentrate the mind, as Dr. Johnson said. And it is, in terms of the kind of writing I do for the magazine, there are assignments as well as articles which I choose or the things that I would want to do. It can be difficult sometimes just trying to figure out how to get into the story. Where do we search for the entry point for the reader? What might be interesting to me may not be interesting to the person who's going to be opening up and seeing it for the first time. So, and then there's also the length considerations that we have to take, because I tend to want to tell more than people may want to know, but I think everything is important. So thankfully we have several good editors who cut me down to size.
The lead is the grabber. Do you have to have your lead sentence in mind before you start?
Well, sometimes... yes, but that will come out of the writing. That comes out of the piece, you know. And quite often it changes. You know, you have the expression that don't bury the lead,
right?
And so you have to put something up top that's going to really grab people, and something that is very active, that is unusual, interesting, that will get people's attention and keep them going. And that's the first rule is not to bore people, you know, and the second rule is to provide them with something they can use. You know, knowing this information going to help me relate better to the world? And so that applies to practically everything we write, because that's one of the functions of Richmond Magazine as the monthly lifestyles guide to living in the metropolitan region, is that we provide utility, you know, and that there is a value added to your experience here in Richmond if you read us and use us, because that's what we're there for.
Do you need to know your ending before you start?
No. I think that the ending comes through the writing. Every story has to have a beginning and a middle and an end. Sometimes, though, it's a moving target, because we're a monthly, and although that gives us a greater expanse of time, an arc of time to cover, I think that what you think is going to be the end at first may not be the end, and then it eventually comes out of what you're writing. I've certainly been in stories where I was, you know, kind of, my boat is so small, the ocean's so big, situations where there's huge amount of information that has to be called through and sifted through, because I have to understand it so I can explain it. to somebody else. And that's one of the big challenges that I find myself in sometimes.
You wind up becoming an expert on whatever you're writing.
It really
about.
Is taking a master's class in whatever I happen to be doing at the time, whether it's a real estate article or a piece about missing persons, or and then of course I do a history column every month too called Flashback. I've been doing that since '93, and that's I think that's probably the favorite thing that I do. The other thing that I'm co-initiator of is the Teresa Pollack Prizes for Excellence in the Arts. Which is our annual recognition of the makers and the creators in the region who contribute to the cultures and the arts in the region. So that's very important to me. And actually, the nomination for that is online at richmag.com. So if you have a particular artist or maker or creator you think is worthy of honoring, receiving public recognition, you should go there.
Mention that website one more time.
Richmag.com.
RichMag.com. How old were you when you knew you wanted to write?
Well, I have a vivid memory of being sprawled across my grandmother's living room with the American Heritage History of the Civil War and a piece of lined notebook paper tracing the words out just to see the march of syllables across a page. And I was probably 9 or 10 when that was going on. And it was just something that I always seemed to have some kind of a facility for, that and being goofy. So the union of goofiness and writerly talent, such as I may have, seemed to have found their expression in various outlets through the magazine, through history writing, and through the Firehouse Theater Project, of which I'm a co-founder, and the Podium Foundation, for which I am on the board, and I'm also going to be reading a selection at our event at the Dogwood Dell on June 13th.
Before we go any further, it might be nice to hear something that you yourself have written in your own voice.
Well,
did you bring something that
I did?
Read?
This is actually from the current issue, from the June issue of Richmond Magazine. And it's somewhat appropriate, as this is about a high school. It's about the destruction of Old John Marshall High, which was downtown. And the wrenching, emotional event that was for people who had gone there. And the reason why it was torn down, and also the fact that now we've moved on, and John Marshall High School, the new John Marshall High School, is one of the participants in the Podium literary effort here. So, I'll be more than happy to read this.
Please.
The end of JM. Old John Marshall High's demolition echoes in collective memory. On June 13, 1960, the revered downtown John Marshall High School's line of graduating classes ended with a final march at the mosque. A new school carrying the same name took its place on the north side the following fall. The original John Marshall was demolished a mere half century and 42,000 day and night school students after its celebratory 1909 opening in 8th and Marshall Streets. It was a bad decision, says Eddie Willard, class of 1951 and head of the John Marshall Alumni Group's History Committee. It was a grand building, marble halls, marble stairs. The city could have modernized it, but they just didn't want to. JM, as the old high school graduates referred to their alma mater in a now almost vanished Richmond accent, came out of an early 20th century movement to create modern public schools. Its inception also demonstrated the stirrings of a preservationist movement that saved Chief Justice John Marshall's house on the corner at 9th. The original efforts to save the house and build the school were later echoed in deliberations about demolishing Marshall High for the City Center project in the early 1960s, which built the new City Hall and the Federal and John Marshall Courts buildings, among others. The original Marshall School was constructed during a period of growth in Richmond, but like most, almost every city institution, it reflected the city's deep divisions. Though a few blocks from a majority black neighborhood, only whites attended or taught there. Marshall soon reached capacity. By 1928, the George Wythe School across Marshall Street, first conceived as a junior high, instead became an annex for the high school. For a time, Marshall held classes in two shifts for its 2,975 pupils. But the architectural DNA of the porticoed and pedimented Marshall contained fatal flaws revealed by time and shifting demands. Architect Charles K. Bryant, who also designed the Empire Theater, didn't include a gymnasium. Instead, the Richmond Gray's Armory on 7th and Marshall Streets was used for indoor athletics and served as headquarters for Marshall's storied cadet corps. It was ultimately razed for the federal building. But in the era of the streetcar, Marshall was showing its age by the 1950s, lacking dedicated parking and air conditioning, which, by the way, wasn't even included in the new Marshall School. And after the U.S. Supreme Court's Brown v. Board of Education decision in 1954, student integration became a national issue. Old Marshall stood at the intersection of new society and utility. School officials contemplated repurposing Marshall as a two-year junior college for approximately $1 million, but city center advocates stymied the idea. The J. Sergeant Reynolds Community College's construction between 7th and 8th Streets caused the demolition of the Richmond Howitzers and 1st Regimental Cavalry's armories. Marshall Senior Philip R. Taylor, a proud cadet corps member and band drum major, addressed city council in the fall of 1961. Taylor asserted, "A shady deal has been made with the federal officials that if they build their office building on a purchase lot, they could get the lot across the street for free." The Wythe Annex got remodeled for city offices while the neglected old Marshall languished. Taylor said that the $3 million replacement Marshall built on the north side in 1960 had already exhibited cracks in its inner block walls and floors. "See if you think it'll stand another 49 years," he declared. "See if you think it'll stand for another 9 years. Frankly, I think the building will be a shambles in 4 years." Taylor, today a vicar of the Free Episcopal Church in eastern North Carolina, recalls, "We were under the impression that a private deal had been struck. We thought if we pushed our point loudly enough, somebody would admit it. Nobody, to my knowledge, ever did." Walter Beverly, a beloved English teacher, led an anti-demolition rally in August 1961. Photographs show orderly but glum students sitting on the steps. "It was a very different and in some ways strange time," Taylor says. "There wasn't a whole city fighting for Marshall's preservation. Instead, they built one of those flat-roofed monstrosities. But they're like that all over the country." In November 1961, the first swings of the 2,000-pound wrecker ball demonstrated the sturdiness of Marshall's brick and granite construction. The ball broke into several pieces.
Great ending.
You can't make stuff like that up.
And you didn't know where you were going? You didn't know you were going towards that ending, or did you?
I did for this one. I mean, that just seemed a natural concluding point because the building's coming down, and in the attempts to do it, the wrecking ball actually broke. In fact, M&M Construction that was won the bid to tear down the building had to go back to city council and ask for more money. Of course, they were the low bidder, and they ran out of money in the demolition process. So the whole thing was just this rather tragic destruction of a city landmark that probably could have been repurposed, but that was not the ambition of the city at that time in the mid-60s.
My guest is Harry Kolatz, who is a senior writer for Richmond Magazine, and the piece he just read was from the current issue of Richmond Magazine. Your column focuses on Richmond history.
Yes.
Are you a native?
I am. I'm a lifer.
Where did you go to school?
See, here's the question, isn't it? You know, I think, frankly, one of your qualifications for Richmondness is that the hospital in which you were born has now gone condo and you can't afford to live there, which would be me. I was born at Richmond Memorial. However, I grew up or was dragged up in the what was then verdant virgin wilderness heart of Chesterfield County, and so actually attended Lloyd C. Burt High School in the class of 1980, first graduating class, and so that's where I went to school.
You've been writing for Richmond Magazine for how long?
I started freelancing there in 1992.
And how long have you been fascinated with the history of our city?
You know, I think I have been fascinated with the history since I can remember. This is a kind of long way around to get it, to explain it, but I will do so quickly. My father collected Etzels. It was an arrangement that he got into with my uncle, and they were going to restore them and sell them. This is in the mid-70s when the Etzels were starting to reappear as classics, and there was an Etzel, there still is an Etzel Owners Club. And anyway, my dad says we only had 13, but I think it was more like 30. They surrounded the house and every yard. It was like some sort of weird 60s, you know, Attack of the Killer Etzels, Roger Corman movie. And I explored those cars. And they came from everywhere. They came from fallow farmers' fields and from widows' garages and junkyards in whatever condition that they found. Some of them were under their own power. Many of them were not. And so I would explore the crooks and crannies of their seats and their glove boxes and under them, under the seats and wherever I could get my hands. And I found some amazing things. I was just as happy as Jacques Cousteau coming up with dirty, grimy nickels from the floorboards of these cars. Or I found my first Broadway playbills from a 1958 wrecked Etzel Citation convertible. On a 3x5 card, I would note the object, which Etzel was found in, and the weather that day. And I put them in a shoebox, which I wish I still had, which I don't. But I also found some Etzel owner's manuals, which I still have. So that, coupled with growing up in Chesterfield County and around so much history, and my natural curiosity for the world just sort of gravitated me to knowing about the purpose of things and the origins of who we are and where we came from and why is the world like it is, what we all ask, particularly young people. And so that's just sort of developed as I did and became more baroque as I went along.
Do you think Richmond is in danger of losing touch with its past?
Well, I think there is that chance. I tell you, though, you know, although I have written about so many buildings and neighborhoods, even total communities that have been demolished and let go, ruined, we were very fortunate in that we still have so much of our architectural heritage remaining. And although, like I said, pieces, parts of that have been destroyed and wiped out even in my lifetime. But people come here. I have brought people out from outside of the city to visit here, and they're amazed. I mean, you walk through Churchill, the Fan, Northside, and there's blocks and blocks of these late 19th century, early 20th century houses that other cities simply don't have. And that's a big point to understanding our past and coming to terms with our traditions and who, what Richmond is, and the good and the bad parts of it. I mean, it's you know, we shouldn't try to sweep things under the rug and hide who we are, because we are what we are, and whatever happened to us in our past has made Richmond what it is. And I think now with throughout the country, the smaller towns are kind of losing in an attrition battle to big corporate names and so forth, and there's a certain amount of that going on in Richmond, to be sure. But as long as we, you know, have some of these porticoed houses that we can drive by, live in, and restore and celebrate, and we have such an incredible texture in Richmond, it's just difficult to ignore it. People want to know about it, and that makes my job, makes it my job to try to explain it.
We have some fairly good resources in Richmond, too, with the Valentine, the Museum of the Confederacy.
And I'm so very fortunate to live so close to them, often within walking distance. And I've gotten to know these institutions really well, and they're very helpful. That's what they're in business to do, is to put you in contact with the information. And to have them all centered here in Richmond is just an incredibly wonderful asset.
The other part of your life that I want to ask you about is your work with the Podium Foundation and the publication Podium. Tell me about your involvement with it and what it is.
Well, Podium is, I think, a rather historic event for the city and for its youth. There has not been a publication like this in quite some time. Different high schools have had different literary or newspapers and so forth, but this is the first time in many, many years that there has been a city-wide literary and arts journal for the high schools, all eight of them. And it is an incredible opportunity for people in those schools to participate in an organization that produces a tangible booklet that has heft and a physical presence and will line up on bookshelves and be a record of their life and their world when they were young. And it also gives us a glimpse and an understanding of that world. And sometimes it's not a very pleasant place to look at, but we have to understand it's our city and these are the children who live here. So I'm very happy to have been a part of this. It's quite groundbreaking in its own sort of quiet way, and we're going to raise that noise level up a bit on June 13th at the Dell.
There's been one issue.
Yes.
One volume, and the second volume is about to come out.
Yes. And that's the second volume is, again, another level up because it's full-color reproduction. We've just had some incredible organizations and people come forward and donate their time and talents to making this publication come into being.
This is The Writer's Voice, and my guest is Harry Kolatz, and you're going to read another writer's voice for
yes,
us.
Yes, I'm going to read another
Tell
writer.
Tell us about this writer and what you're going to read.
Well, the title of the piece is It's a Personal Essay. This is one of the categories of work that appears on Podium. This is called The Best Years Ever by Brianna Blunt. She is a junior at Thomas Jefferson High School. The best years of my life would have to be when I lived with Nanny. Her real name was Etta Fennell. She was my great aunt by marriage, but I've known her and called her Nanny all my life. My Nanny was one of the most beautiful women I have ever known. Around 5'5", she had a caramel complexion and long gray hair. She was a kind woman who would do anything for anybody. She had the most beautiful and warm smile. She was an amazing woman with a way of making me feel great about myself no matter how I felt at the moment. I first started staying at her house when I was almost a year old. My mother dropped me off during the day on her way to work at the bank. By the time I turned a year old, Nanny had helped me learn to walk. By the age of 16 months, she'd also potty trained me. When I turned 3, my mother and I moved in with Nanny and Big Daddy, my great uncle William and Nanny's husband, after my mother and father separated. During this time, I fell absolutely in love with her. Sometimes I would forget that she wasn't my real grandmother. She treated me like I was her family, maybe because I was the first little girl to ever live with her. I loved staying at her house. It was the best house ever. It had 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, a living room, a dining room, a sun porch where I could watch television with Big Daddy, an attic, and 2 sheds. In one room, there was even a waterbed I loved to play on. We moved to Richmond when I was 4, but it seemed every other weekend I was there. In the middle of the night, I would sneak in her room and sleep between Nanny and Big Daddy. After a while, she would ask me if I wanted to sleep in there. During this time, she taught me how to say my prayers every night before I went to sleep. Then she would tuck me in, and I fell asleep with her rubbing my head. As I grew, my cousin Ty and I would always fight over something. Toys, food, anything I wanted. Didn't matter if he had it first. I would tell Nanny, and I would get it most of the time. Once I realized this, I did things on purpose. Just to get my way, I whined, and she always came to my aid. When I was 11, they moved out of my dream house. I remember my last night there. They told me they were moving. I cried leaving the house to head back to Richmond. Moving out of that house was like losing a piece of my childhood. Running through the house, watching television, Rugrats to be exact, helping Nanny cook, eating banana ice pops, learning how to eat crabs and fish without choking on the bones and shells. All those memories began in that house. When they moved, I didn't stay at their new apartment. I barely saw her anymore, but she was always on my mind. Every once in a while, I would call her just to check up on her and hear her voice. The last time I saw Nanny was Thanksgiving of 2006. I was at my cousin's new house with my family and real grandmother. She called and asked if I wanted to go with her. Of course I said yes, and 15 minutes later she picked me up. I stayed with her the rest of the day, the best day ever. I don't remember ever being that happy. Whenever I was around her, all my problems faded away. In June of 07, I found out how sick Nanny was. She had breast cancer and was trying to fight it. The last time I talked to her was at the end of June. I had made plans to see her, but since my mother had just had surgery on her hip, I chose to stay and help her instead. In July of 2007, at the age of 76, Nanny died before I got a chance to see her again. Sometimes I think I wasn't meant to see her sick. Whenever I think about her, I think of her on that Thanksgiving, looking healthy and beautiful. There's not a day that goes by that I don't think of her as my own personal angel watching down on me. I miss Nanny so much.
That's pretty powerful, right?
Yeah, I mean, that is.
The detail makes it.
Absolutely. And this is the kind of thing where you simply don't know what these young people are going through if you were to see them on the street or on the bus. You just don't know. There's an inner life that has to be tapped into. And this is what one of the functions of Podium is to allow these young people to speak. This is their forum. This is the opportunity for them to speak and to be heard in a way that's going to be enduring. You know, it's in print. It's forever, theoretically. You know, it's certainly, it's not the internet. You know, it's going to, although we do have a website, podiumfoundation.com, where you can go. This is what it's about. It's about the print. It's about the actual book itself. There's just nothing like holding a book in your hand with words that you wrote and being able to pass it around and show it to people and say, I did this. And I hope that, who knows what will come out of it. You know, who knows where these people will go. That's one of the exciting aspects of this for me, because we simply can't predict what will be the arc of the future of these young people. And I hope a few of them actually turn into actual writers and commit themselves to that life. It's not always an easy one. But there are all kinds of ways you can go and use that talent. So, and the world needs them.
Tell us again who the author of this piece was.
The author was Brianna Blunt, and she is a junior at Thomas Jefferson High School.
Are you finding the quality level from each volume to be this good?
Once these people are given the opportunity to write about their lives, whether it's either through this sort of thing, personal essay, or adapting maybe some of that to fiction, or just going out of left field and writing something that they've created, you understand that there's a rich creativity in these people, in these young people, that we sometimes sort of dismiss because we think they're all playing video games or they're watching television. And they are doing that because they are young people. There is there. But there's a tremendous amount going on. And it's so wonderful to be able to see that and to hear it. It's something that has really changed my perceptions, and I hope that will be changing the perceptions of others as well.
So what's next for Harry Kolatz? Where's your mind going these days in Richmond's history and things you want to write about?
Well, as you know, I have two books out already, True Richmond Stories, which is basically a somewhat of a compilation of my flashback columns from many years. And then there's Richmond and Ragtime, Socialist, Suffragist, Sex, and Murder. Three rambunctious years, 1909 to 1910. And both of those are offered through the History Press and are available wherever finer books are sold, and Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com. And what's next? I think I'm sort of contemplating that. It would take a considerable amount of time and effort and research. I would like to do a book about the 1920s and 30s. That's just the natural progression. And it's a very rich time. And figuring out the narrative flow of that, and at the beginning, the middle, and the end, we know, you know, where it would end. But trying to figure out how to relate, what are the biggest, there's a tremendous amount of events going on in the arts and the culture here, and a terrible mayor by the name of Fulmer Bright, who was in power for 16 years. And so those are the kinds of things that I need to be weaving in and out of the story. And how to do that, I haven't quite figured out yet, but I'm hoping to do that. That's probably my next undertaking historically.
As somebody who's spent a lifetime as a writer looking at Richmond's past, are you optimistic about the city's future?
Oh, I think I'm in some ways more optimistic than I have been. Being a Richmonder, I have kind of a loving-loathing relationship.
Yeah.
It's like being married for a very, very long time, and there's some things you just have to let go. You know, this isn't going to change. However, particularly with the way the city is approaching now preservation and also the very active conservation preservation movements that are very active in the city right now for the history aspect. And people are moving back into the city. People are moving from other places into the city and who are discovering it for the first time. I didn't know, what was this place? Why, and so I get to be something of a translator for them in some regards, which I very much enjoy. Sort of explaining Richmond to people, and I am optimistic, guardedly optimistic. Let me put it to you that way, because I think that there's some tremendous things going on. And Podium is one example of that. The Firehouse Theater Project, of which I'm a co-founder, is another example of that. And Richmond Magazine too, I should point out.
Definitely. Richmond is a city of many voices, and Harry Kolatz is one of the city's more distinctive voices. He is a senior writer for Richmond Magazine and a board member of the Podium Foundation. And Harry, thanks for being with us.
You've been listening to Don Dale interviewing Harry Kolatz about the Podium Foundation and the Podium Volume 2. Coming up next, we have Brick Ryder interviewing Tarfia Faizula, also about the Podium and about her own poetry.
We're speaking with Tarfia Faizula, who's just graduated from VCU, right?
Yes.
And your degree is?
Master's of Fine Arts in Creative Writing Poetry.
Oh, and have you published yet?
Yes, I've been published in several literary journals.
And your poetry you would describe as what kind of poetry? All over the world, or?
I would say that I'm very interested in formal poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also interested in poetry that sort of explores what it is to be a South Asian in America.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also interested in writing about grief, as I lost a sibling about 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I understand you brought some of your poetry with us.
I have.
Would you read one for us?
Sure. This is called Award Ceremony. Dusk again, sun and horizon yoked to one another. All day I have looked for you in the likeliest places. Pages of photo albums frozen with disuse, mapped the porcelain curves of portraits of your girlfriends, now grown up, married, drunk, infertile. How can a child remain a child? You are, instead, in the forsythia that blooms the paths to the old brown doors of the chapel where I sat today, waiting to give a child an award bearing the memory of your name. Sister, it is years since I visited your grave. I have never seen its granite headstone, only the plastic box that once bore your name.
That's lovely.
Thank you.
When one sits down to a blank piece of paper and says, I'm going to write some poetry, are you walking into that situation with an idea already in the back of your head, or do you have to just sit there and work on it till something goes pop? How does it work for you in part of the creative process?
I would say that I never sit down to a blank piece of paper. That is far too intimidating for me, I think. I think instead that I sort of collect material. I record observations. I take a lot of notes. If I read something that strikes me as interesting, I write that down, and then I sort of think of myself as this receptacle that fills up, and when I feel like it's full, then I usually sit down and I try to start piecing the things I've been thinking about together. So that's one way that it happens. I think other times I do what you're talking about, where I have an idea that I've sort of been working on, but I usually have to carry an idea around with me for a while before I have to let it simmer, so to speak.
A lot of back brain work on that, isn't there?
I mean, I would say so.
Things that you see, smell, feel, touch.
Absolutely.
Don't necessarily come to the front part and say, hey, here I am. But you do absorb those, don't you? Now, how do you tap into them? I mean, is that a construct that you use to get back there to those feelings and thoughts, or is it just happen for you?
I think it can happen both ways. Sometimes it's really messy and really disorderly, and like I said, sometimes I'm writing one thing down and then crossing it out immediately, or typing something out and deleting an entire chunk of it, or maybe even taking one line and moving it somewhere else. Or scrapping the entire thing together and storming off in a frustrated rage, depending on what happens. But I think that most of the time, when it's going really well, I would say that it ends up being sort of a mysterious process. I'm not exactly sure what happens. I just know that suddenly something is feeling right and really natural, and the writing is coming fairly naturally. And then it's really in the revising process that I think that I use more the left part of my brain, the more intellectual part of my brain, to revise, to really take a look at things like grammar or syntax or formal aspects of the poem. But until that point, until the revising point, it's just a lot of feeling it out.
What attracted you to poetry rather than good old-fashioned prose?
I don't know. I've always written poetry since I was a little girl.
Oh.
And I took a poetry class in college at the University of Texas at Austin, and I just sort of fell in love with the poetry that we were reading in that class that professor sort of led us to. And I just kept writing poetry and kept reading poetry, and then eventually ended up, you know, applying for the master's program.
In the number of different poetry classes that you've had, you also have the opportunity to grade your professors. You have one that really stood out?
Well, I think all of them stood out in very different ways. The first poetry class I took, Jennifer Tong, was, I think, really the first person who showed me that you could be a writer of poetry and you could have that be your primary vocation.
Mm-hmm.
Up till that point, I had been thinking about poetry as something one did on the side, more as a hobby, and she was really the one who encouraged me to really think about doing it full time. And I think the professors here I've had at VCU, David Wojon, Claudia Emerson, and Gregory Donovan, have all been huge influences as well in one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever, I know you have not been out of VCU that long, but do you ever want to go back and get a doctorate?
Not right now. I'm a little academia'd out at the moment.
Okay,
but,
I can understand that.
Yeah, but it is something that I'm, you know, I have it in the back of my brain. So maybe in a few years we'll see. But
any idea that you might want to be a teacher of poetry?
Yes, absolutely. I taught more than one undergraduate class at VCU in poetry, and really enjoyed it, and it's something that I hope to be able to return to sooner than later.
Now, you're also involved in the book, magazine, pamphlet, literary journal. That's the word I was trying to find. I'm going to do an edit right there. Thank you. You're also involved in the literary journal, The Podium. Tell us about The Podium, and then tell me how you got involved.
Okay. Podium is a journal that is put together by the Podium Foundation with the goals of getting high school, Richmond area high school students engaged in the writing, reading, and editing of poetry, fiction, short memoir, and opinion. And Podium publishes illustrations as well. So it's really a way for high school students to tap into their more creative processes.
And how did you get involved with them?
I got an email through from the English department at VCU sort of recruiting mentors for the Podium Foundation, and it sounded like a really terrific idea to me. I thought that it was important, and I still think it's important and worthwhile that students at any age really are encouraged to read and write and think about literature.
I understand that Podium is available free, both in the libraries and in bookstores, but there's a special event coming up on the 13th at Dogwood Dell where the Podium will also be available for you for free, as it is in all the other locations. And that event on the 13th is at 8 p.m. at Dogwood Dell. Continuing our conversation about Podium, you've been published in Podium, right?
Oh, no. Podium is actually...
I mean, you've been an advisor.
Yes, Podium. I've been one of the mentors.
A mentor, they call them. Okay. Who'd you work with?
I worked with different students from different Richmond area high schools, public schools, and these particular students were involved in putting together the journal. They were the editors of the journal, so they chose every piece of writing and every illustration that went into the journal. And we were really there to, can I start that over, please?
Sure.
We were there to offer them guidance and maybe to point out strengths or weaknesses in the pieces that they were looking at, maybe things that they were going to dismiss, we sort of would point out, well, maybe you could take another look at it and think about it this way. But we really encourage them to have ownership and agency over the entire process of choosing the items for the journal. So Podium is a journal that not only publishes high school work, but all of the work is selected by high school students as well.
That must be a pretty exciting thing to be able to see that spark. When
Absolutely.
You're working with a high school student who didn't quite get it, and then all of a sudden you can kind of open a door for them and get them somewhere.
Absolutely, and it's really wonderful, too, to see high school students have such ownership over the process and ownership over their own opinions. That was one of the really wonderful things, was to hear, to see these kids sitting at a table and saying things like, well, I like it because of this, or, well, I dislike it because of this, and being able to offer their opinions and then come to a joint decision.
Now tell me about teaching the Teachers Academy. What's that?
Well, the T3 Academy is a seminar that I and two other VCU English professors are going to be running at the end of July that will be offering brainstorming, guidance, strategies for high school teachers to adopt into their classrooms to promote creative writing, to encourage students to write more creatively. And so basically it's a week-long seminar where from 9 to 5 they will be in workshops, they will be reading poetry, short fiction, nonfiction, and they will be learning ways to incorporate creative writing more into their classrooms in the hopes that the students will get really excited and write more creatively and write better and better work that will eventually end up in the Podium Literary Journal.
For you, when did the lightning strike you as wanting to write?
I've written since I was a little girl. I wrote poetry when I was a little girl, and I was very shy and awkward and bookish, and I felt like books were my friends. I still feel like books are my best friends, and I really felt like writing was a way for me to express privately what I couldn't say out loud.
Is the same thing going to happen to the high school kids?
I certainly hope so. That's certainly the hopes.
So it's more than just writing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's always more than just writing. Yeah, I really feel like writing is a way of seeing, and I think that a lot of these kids are using language anyway, Facebook, text messages, that sort of thing. The internet certainly allows for a lot of language to be used every day, and we are hoping to encourage them to use the language they already have some kind of handle on more creatively. I really believe that creative writing enables someone to see the world differently, and recording the world that they're seeing through those different eyes will serve them well in any field of study, whether it's even scientific.
I would love it if you would read some more of your poetry to us.
Okay, I would love to.
Okay.
This is actually a poem that is located in Richmond, Virginia. And I know that y'all remember all of the crazy snow we were having this year. So this is a poem that is inspired by that. Poetry recitation at St. Catherine's School for Girls. And it has an epigraph. If this were the beginning of a poem, he would have called the thing he felt inside him the silence of snow. Orhan Pamuk from his novel, Snow. We are here to listen. so we remove from the hollows of straight-backed wooden chairs, old blue hymnals, wait for the girls to file in, and take our seats. Below the hanging cross, they take turns standing attention before us with eyes closed or hands clasped, headbands bright green or bangles yellow, glints that fill the air like falling snow. They recite poems they have carried in their mouths for days, and my desire to go back, to be one among these slender, long-haired girls, is a thistle, sharp and twisting at my side. After, we bend our heads in prayer for a teacher's son, my age, passed out, found frozen in snow. The words blessing, psalm, Lord, rise in me like bees heavy with pollen, and the teenager I once was unzips herself from me, emerges, a crocus bristling through snow, and she is back in the old chapel where the priest again declaims about the kingdom of God, gifts promised only to the righteous. The girl I was, heavy and slow in her thick glasses, knew she would never enter heaven, never be these girls singing, arms pale and slim as the white birch whose branches, dappled with gold, shade each stained glass window. In Pamuk's novel, all the headscarf girls in eastern Turkey hang themselves rather than go uncovered. And there is a girl in me who once longed for such conviction, who sits beside me now, pulls on her hair, sucks long strands of it deep into her mouth, and then I am gathering her in my arms, shaking her, telling her to listen, that the sky will always happen, the branches, that there are many more bodies inside this clumsy one. I think again of the dead sun lying under the cold, dark sheaves of night sky. Will my gaze away from snow that must have melted beneath his still warm body before it cooled again, hardened into ice. Before this loss, too, we are helpless, but I must push the heavy amber of her back inside me. Soon I will not know if I want to preserve her, so we sing the words we know by heart beside these girls who will grow into or away from their bodies. Sometimes it causes me to tremble, tremble, we sing. Our voices rise, fall, sway and shudder on the last familiar notes.
And the title again is?
Poetry Recitation at St. Catherine's School for Girls. I went to Episcopalian school from the time I was 5 till the time I graduated from high school.
Ah.
So it was a familiar landscape for me.
Yeah. How about another poem that you've written?
Okay. This is a poem called You Ask Why Write About It Again, and it's sort of addressed to a professor of mine who was encouraging me not to write similar subject material over the course of many poems. And I got kind of angry, so I wrote this in response to him saying that. You ask why write about it again. Because the morning's already exhausted light exposes a child's handprints smudged on cream and green walls. Because the deaf child cannot know the sounds of her own grief. Because sleep comes or does not come. The hand pressed hard against the window does not want to be the hand that lifts the pen again to write the word sister, the word silence. The hand desires blossoms instead, blue hyacinths, whorls of pooled wax. Because the blade held by the hand is still a blade, even when used for crushing and not cutting, dill, cardamom, a bulb of garlic, pink and yellow pills. Because we want to be hand and blade and window, but are stains on walls instead. Praise the lantern mottled with dusk, the heft and shimmer of grief, unnamed but questioned. Praise the red leaves and white candle, the metal canisters brimming with lentils, cumin, fennel. Praise the ailanthus moth spinning its coarse silk because it cannot stop and it must.
I understand that you have some of the poems that are in the the current issue of the journal. Would you
yes.
read some to us?
Absolutely. This is called I Thought I Heard America Singing, and it's by LaKayla Bonaparte, she was a sophomore last year at Huguenot High School. I thought I heard America singing. I thought I heard it, America singing. It was in the wail of a mother who can't pay her bills. The chemical gases our children are breathing. Oh, say, can you hear it? In the last words of a soldier, in a politician's laugh. I hear so clear, America. And if I did, I'll call the radio stations and make a warrant for this song, to end it for eternity. For that kind of song can never be put on any iPod. Excuse me, on my iPod. We must start from scratch and make a new song, and its percussion will beat with new life, new love. Now that's what I call music. And this is a poem called Misunderstood by Brittany Williams, also from Huguenot High School. Misunderstood. Words flow in my mind like fish in the sea. I might try to unwind, but my mind won't let this be. Therefore, I try to get the words out my mind and put them down on paper. Because if I don't write them down, then later you would not be able to hear them. My pen explodes like gasoline vapors, releasing my feelings of hatred, love, happiness, and anger. But to me, I don't know what is stranger, the feelings in my mind or the words on this paper.
You have been listening to an interview of Tarfia Faizullah by Brick Ryder for the Virginia Voice. This has been the Sunday Special.